doesn't matter. I don't want to bother with that. Let's just take omega to be, so to speak, the classical case, the minimum of t in 1, so that we're back in the setting of Cm. So today we're working in Cm of Rn, today the jet of a function f at a point x is the m minus first degree Taylor polynomial of f at x. I shouldn't say today, I should say in this lecture. It'll change in the next lecture. Script p is the vector space of all such. Okay, so we're expanding things to order m minus 1. As usual, we're given a finite set E in Rn, and for each x in E and for each L non-negative integer, we're given a symmetric convex set sigma L in P, and for each x in E and for each L and for each positive M, we're given a possibly empty convex set gamma L contained in P. Okay? These satisfy a laundry list of properties. I just want to recall quickly what the properties are. There are some of them on the slide. I think I won't bother to say what they are, and I'll just look. If there are any questions, or if anything isn't clear, especially if anything is wrong, please tell me. So there are some properties. There's another crucial property, and I'm going to summarize that by saying that the gamma is essentially a translated m times the sigma. Notice that two constants enter into this into these inclusions, C1 and C2. So when C1 and C2 appear in the conclusion of the theorem, that's what C1 and C2 are. Okay. Here's the statement that if I give you a P in a particular gamma associated to X, then for any nearby Y, you can find a P prime in a gamma L minus 1 associated to Y, which lies close to the P in the sense of Taylor's theorem. And I'm going to refer to that by saying we can move to nearby points. Okay, and there's an analogous condition for the sigmas. Okay, then there's this Whitney T convexity, which says that if P is in a sigma, then you sometimes get to multiply it by Q and essentially stay in the same sigma, provided P and Q satisfy certain estimates which look familiar from the classical Whitney extension theorem. Okay? And notice that there a constant C sub W, the Whitney constant, enters. And so when in the statement of the main theorem you see C sub W, remember that's what C sub W is. Okay. Under those assumptions, we're going to prove the following. So here's the main theorem. So I give you a polynomial P0 in gamma L star of, I've got a particular point X0 over a particular M0. And this L star is a large enough integer constant depending only on which function space we're working in. Under those conditions, there exists a capital F of the following properties. So first of all, its derivatives are controlled. Its CM norm is controlled by a constant multiple of M0. Its jet at every point X and E, the jet at every point belongs to the gamma 0. That tells us that in particular cases that the jet agrees with the function little f that we're trying to interpolate. But here we've generalized so much that there no longer is a function little f that we're trying to interpolate. There are just gammas and sigmas. And so this is the remaining condition that expresses that. And finally, at the base point x0, the jet is equal to p0. Now there's this constant c star, and the story is that it depends only on little m and little n, the parameters that tell us which function space we're working in, and on those three constants, c1, c2, and cw, that appear in the assumptions. So that's the main theorem, okay? And we saw in the past that if this theorem is right, then a whole lot of other theorems follow, and basically we understand what happens for Cm of Rn restricted to finite sets E. Okay, so that's essentially the main theorem from the preceding lecture. Okay, so the rest of this lecture sketches the proof of that theorem. So I'm going to keep everything I've said so far in this lecture. I'm going to keep the setting assumptions throughout. Okay. All right. And I'm going to make a convention that whenever I write a constant denoted by the letter C, one way or the other, those depend only on the constants in our assumptions and the little m and little n. But as usual in proofs with estimates, these constants are little c, big c, whatever. These things may denote different constants in different occurrences. Okay. All right. Now, so I want to prove the main theorem. Now, in order to do that, we're going to consider local versions of the interpolation problem. So I want to explain what a local interpolation problem is. Okay. So let's fix the e's, the gammas, the sigmas, and m0 as just discussed. But now I'm going to look at a local problem, and so I imagine that I'm given a cube, q0. It's not the unit cube, it's just the particular cube that I happen to be looking at and to which I'm localizing. I'm given a point x0, which is in E, and either in q0 or in not too far, let's say it's in the intersect 3q0, and some polynomial p0. Okay, so that's what I'm given. And now the problem, the local interpolation problem, denoted lip, lip not for Lipschitz, but for local interpolation problem, okay? Lip of q0, x0, p0 is the following problem. Find the function f in Cm, not everywhere, but merely on the cube 3q0, with the three properties in the box. So if we don't look too closely, then you think, well, the derivatives of f are controlled by Cm0, the jet of f at points x belong to gamma 0 as they are supposed to, and as we would like, but of course only for x and e that happen to belong to q or to some dilate, let's say 1.01 times q. And the jet at the base point, x0 is equal to the given p0. If we look a little more closely, there's a slight refinement. Look at the first green box, and you'll see that there are estimates on the derivatives only of order precisely m. There's no statement in that box about derivatives of order less than m. But that's okay, because the third box tells us what the Taylor polynomial of degree m minus 1 is at the base point. And so we can recover our information about lower derivatives by just looking at how p0 behaves, and then remembering that the highest order derivatives are controlled. Okay, is that clear? All right, so that is what a local interpolation problem is. Given the data, including x0, q0, x0, and p0, the local interpolation problem is the problem of finding an f with these properties localized to the cube q0. There's the first occurrence of a misprint that I noticed. I guess these cubes should be q0s. Okay. Anyway, all right, the main theorem can just be rephrased by saying that we can solve local interpolation problems whenever the relevant cube is the unit cube. Okay, we cover Rn with unit cubes. In each unit cube, we solve a local interpolation problem. The assertion is we can always do that, and then we patch them together with some harmless partition of unity. We've had Whitney partitions of unity so far, and they're scary because the cutoff functions there live on very small length scales and therefore have great big derivatives, and we need to worry. But for a harmless partition of unity on adapted to a covering of Rn by unit cubes, there's nothing to worry about. So our main theorem can simply be rephrased easily by saying that any local interpolation problem can be solved provided that Q0 is the unit cube. All right, so that's what we've got to prove. Now, in fact, we're going to prove that any local interpolation problem can be solved, provided only that the P0 belongs to gamma L star for this large integer constant of the base point x0 and m0. Okay, so any local interpolation problem can be solved, provided that the given polynomial P0 belongs to a simple gamma. And if we can prove that, we will have proved the main theorem, and therefore all the stuff that I've talked about regarding regarding CM and finite sets. Okay. Now, in order to do that, we're going to measure the difficulty of a local interpolation problem by attaching to it a label. A label is a rather simple object. It's simply a subset of the set script down of all multi-indices of order at most little n minus 1. So that's what a label is. So, all right, we're going to label local interpolation problems with these sets A. So these labels A also come with a total order relation, which I won't define precisely, but it's just a simple variant of ordinary lexicographic order. And the point of labels and the order relation less than is that, roughly speaking, if one label is less than another, then we expect that a typical local interpolation problem that carries the label A is easier than a typical local interpolation problem carrying the label B. So labels allow us to look at, to compare one local interpolation problem with another and decide which one we think is easier. In particular, if A is a subset of B, then B will precede A in the order. And therefore, according to this way of thinking, the empty set, which is a label because it's a set of multi-indices, the empty set labels the hardest problems, and the set script down of all multi-indices of order at most n minus 1 labels the easiest problems. Okay? I don't want to give a misleading impression. A given interpolation problem typically carries more than one label, not just one. Okay. So I'd like to explain how to attach a label to a local interpolation problem, and then explain how to use labels to reduce hard local interpolation problems to easier ones, and thus prove the main theorem. That's the point. Okay, so how do we attach labels to local interpolation problems? So let's give definitions and simplest properties. Okay, so to assign a label to a local interpolation problem, we're going to look at the size and shape of the sigma, and we use the following definition. All right, so suppose we're given sigma, a convex symmetric set in script P, our space of polynomials. We're given a label A, we're given a point X of Rn, and we're given two positive numbers. Cb is to be thought of as some sort of large but harmless constant, but delta is to be thought of as a small length scale. Okay? Then I want to describe an A delta Cb basis for sigma at X. That's a large collection of words, so I will often just say A basis. All right. So such a thing is a family of polynomials P alpha indexed by the multi-indices in the label A with the properties of the box. So first of all, look at the first bullet point. If you look at the derivatives of the polynomials P alpha evaluated at this point X, then as long as, well, of course, the alpha automatically belongs to A because that's the set of P alphas we're given. But the beta could be anything. But if the beta also belongs to A, then we get some identity matrix, these derivatives of Kronecker delta. If beta does not necessarily belong to A, then in place of saying exactly what the derivatives are, we have some estimates. And that's the second bullet point. So far, I've told you how the polynomials behave, but I haven't said anything about sigma or what these things have to do with sigma. And the third bullet point explains that some rescaled versions of the alpha belong to sigma or to anyway a constant times sigma, the constant Cb. So this is the definition of an A delta Cb basis. And I'm sorry, it looks sort of technical, but anyway, there it is. Okay, is it clear? No objections? Now, the rule for attaching a label to a local interpolation problem is this. First of all, we carefully pick our L. It's going to depend on A and also on which function space we're working in. So it depends only on the label. And we're going to carefully pick some big constants called Cs and Cb. And I'm not going to worry about exactly what they are, but they're determined by it says on the slide. So I carefully pick some constants. I fix my delta to be the sine length of the Q0 in the statement of the problem. Okay? And we attach the label A to this problem if and only if the sigma at the base point x0 given in the problem, the sigma sub L, where L is the L indicated by the label A, if that has an A basis, as indicated on the slide. That's the rule. Okay? I will soon explain, I hope it's on the very next slide, I will soon explain something relatively useful about that. Let's see. Yes, the label A tells us then how much room to maneuver we have inside gamma L of x0 and 0, more precisely we have the following. So suppose that our local interpolation problem carries a label A according to the preceding definition. And suppose that P0 belongs to gamma L of A associated to x0 and to m0, or maybe to some constant times m0. Now, we look at the derivatives of P0 at x0, but not all derivatives, only the derivatives of order alpha, where alpha belongs to the set A. And we may not like them, and so we would like to change them. And so this lemma says that if I give you a set of real numbers C alpha indexed by the label A, and if they're not too big, and there's the estimate, absolute C alpha is less than or equal to a constant times M0 times the length of the Q0 to some power, okay? If that's true, then there is a polynomial in essentially the same gamma. The M0 has gotten a bit bigger, but we don't care. There is a P tilde in essentially the same gamma, but whose derivatives have been modified. Namely, for alpha in A, we've been able to add the C alpha to the derivatives. So we have freedom to choose some of the derivatives, and that's what a label indicates. Okay. Remember that our gamma, our sigma is likely to be big in certain directions and small in certain other directions. And the big directions are the directions that cause trouble because our set maybe lies close to the, our set E lies close to the zero set of some polynomial, that polynomial providing the direction. So this sort of resonates with that idea. This one might think that labels actually have something to do with the problem. Okay? Alright. So, and the lemma follows trivially from the definitions together with the fact that the gamma is essentially a translated m times the sigma. I won't go through the verification, but if you just look at the definitions, it follows. Alright. So now, alright, so labels tell us in which directions the gamma L is long, and again, those are the directions that are the source of the trouble. Okay. A few little remarks on labels. An A basis is a family of polynomials indexed by K. In particular, if A is the empty set, an A basis consists of absolutely nothing. There has to be a P alpha for every alpha in the empty set. So the empty set is special in that every local interpolation problem carries the label of the empty set. Suppose that A prime is a subset of A, and suppose that you have an A basis, as on the slide. Well, you can simply forget about some of those P alpha and look only at the P alpha that belong to A prime. And you will then have an A prime basis. And so thanks to that trivial observation and a couple of others, we learned the following, that every local interpolation problem that carries the label A also carries the label A prime for every subset A prime in A. So it's true with a vengeance that local interpolation problems may carry on. Okay? All right. Here's a fact that will turn out to be important. I'm afraid the explanation of why this is important is not the one that's clearest. But anyway, notice that in talking about the rule for attaching a label to an interpolation problem, the rule mentions the Q0 to provide the delta. And it mentions x0 because that's where the thing is supposed to be a basis, but it never mentions the polynomial p0. And so the assignment of a label to a local interpolation problem is independent of p0. That's good because we're perhaps going to the first, later on we're going to pick some cube and some base point based on what we think the label would be, and then later we will pick the p0. And that's why we're able to do that. All right, so given all that, what's the situation? Well, we want to prove our main theorem. We've defined local interpolation problems. We've seen that our main theorem simply asserts, or anyway follows from the fact that any local interpolation problem can always be solved provided that the p0 belongs to an appropriate gamma. We've decided that we're going to measure the difficulty of a local interpolation problem by attaching labels. And we've seen the definition of a label and the rule that tells us when we may attach a given label to a given local interpolation problem. And the plan is to use labels to reduce hard local interpolation problems to easier ones. And the labels come with a total order relation less than, so that heuristically we think that a typical interpolation problem that carries a label A is easier than a typical interpolation problem that carries a label B, provided that A is less than B. And so that's good. If we're trying to reduce hard local interpolation problems to easier ones, we need some way of deciding when we think a problem is harder or when we think it's easier, and that's done by this order relation on labels, which are attached to the local interpolation problems. Okay. And remember that if A is containing B, B is less than A in the order, and so the whole set script down of all multi-indices of the appropriate order is minimal, and the empty set is maximal. I think that's enough review. Yes, enough review. All right, so now let's see how we're going to prove the main theorem using those ideas. Okay. By induction on the label A with respect to this order relation, we're going to prove the following. So here is the main lemma for A. So let's take any local interpolation problem that carries the label A. Let's let P0 belong to gamma sub L of A, where L of A is some carefully chosen integer constant that depends on the label of A. And then the claim is that local interpolation problem has a solution. So that's some version of the main thing we want to do to solve any local interpolation problem, but it depends on the A in that we assume that the local interpolation problem carries the label A, and when we say that P0 belongs to a gamma, the label A influences which gamma. Okay? So that's the main lemma for A, and our plan is to prove that by induction on the label A with respect to the order relation less than. Okay, now remember, here's what a solution to a local interpolation problem looks like, which is becoming the definition. Okay, and because every local interpolation problem carries the label of the empty set, the main lemma for the special case in which the label is the empty set tells us that any local interpolation problem for which the P0 belongs to an appropriate gamma, namely the gamma L, where L is the L associated to the empty set, has a solution, and that's what we wanted. That is precisely what we wanted. So we really only care about the main lemma for the case of the empty set, but the proof of the main lemma is by induction on the label, and the empty set is the very last label, so we have to worry about all labels. Andre?
So, Charlie, what's the
dependence
of this L on
So let me in fact tell you what it is. So there is this, so there are these labels A, they are just sets of multi-indices, okay? L of A is the following. So look at A and ask how many other labels precede A in the order. Take that number, multiply it by 3 and add 1. That's L of A. Okay? And questions. Okay, please note it is possible to ask a question and get a reasonable answer. Okay, so, all right. So that's, all right, so the special case of the dilemma for the case of the label, the empty set, is what we're supposed to prove, and so absolutely everything about CM for finite sets comes down to proving the main lemma for any set, for any label A, for any set of multiple indices. Okay, now, the main, let's see how much time I'm not going to do, okay. All right, so let's prove the main lemma. We are going, again, we're going to use induction on the label with respect to the order relation, and so we have to start the base case. So our label is the minimal label under the order relation, which remembers the set of all multi-indices. So I've got to prove the main lemma for script M. Okay. So let's say we've got a local interpolation problem that carries the label script M, and suppose that P0 is in gamma 1 of X0 comma N0. So in particular, if our label is M, then this that L of the label is 1, which is consistent with my answer to Andrea's question, okay, because nothing precedes script M in the order. Okay, now, because this local interpolation problem carries the label script M, there is room to maneuver in all directions. Remember, we decided that if a local interpolation problem carries a label A, then there is room to maneuver inside the gamma in the directions corresponding to that label. And now this label consists of everything, and so there is room to maneuver in all directions. And so, if you look at gamma 1 of, well, of x0, not exactly m0, that m0 should be a constant times m0. But if you look at that gamma 1, it contains some ellipsoid about p0, or some box about p0, as in the picture. So there, that convex set there is supposed to be a picture of gamma 1 of x0 and 0, and p0 is the polynomial that we're given as part of the local interpolation problem, and the dotted line indicates an ellipsoid, a suitable ellipsoid, and all those points lie inside a suitable gamma 1 because there is room to maneuver. So that's where we use the fact that this carries the label script M. Okay? Now, remember a basic property of the gammas and sigmas, namely, you can move from one point to a nearby point. So, given any p in gamma 1 of x0, p0, and given any point y reasonably close to x0, you could find a p tilde in the gamma 0 that satisfies the estimate that I've shown you. Okay? Now, what I'd like to do is apply that to all the blue dots on the boundary of the ellipsoid in this picture. So if I move from x0 to a nearby point y, then near every one of those blue dots is some red dot that belongs to the gamma 0 at the nearby point. Is that clear? All right, and so here's the picture. We have the blue points that lie at gamma 1 of x0, m0. We have some nearby point y, and we have a family of red dots, so it will be some kind of funny distorted ellipsoid. And near every blue dot is a red dot, and the red dots lie in gamma 0 of y, n0. Okay. Well, in particular, remember gamma 0 is convex. And so if all of those red dots lie in gamma 0 of y, then p0 itself lies in gamma 0 of y, as in the slide. And that happens for all y close enough to x0. And in particular, if you look carefully at how close y has to be in order for this argument to work, you will find that this works for all y to be that lie in 1.01 q0. So now we know that our polynomial p0 lies in the appropriate gamma for all y in E that lie in 1.01 q0. And so therefore, to solve our local interpolation problem, I'm just going to take my interpol of capital F to be the polynomial P0 itself. That's a pretty easy way to interpolate. Okay? And let's just check that it works. So here are the three conditions in the red boxes, the three conditions that F is supposed to satisfy. First of all, there are supposed to be estimates on the highest order derivative, the nth order derivatives of F on 3Q0. Well, the F that we picked is a polynomial of degree m minus 1, so we have excellent estimates for its nth derivatives. Okay, they are 0. Now let's think about the jet of our F at any point x. Well, our F is already a polynomial of degree m minus 0, so it's Taylor polynomial at any point. Its Taylor polynomial of degree m minus 1 is itself. So the jet at any x of our F is equal to p0. In particular, at the base point, x0, the jet of F is equal to the given p0. That's one of the things our local interpolation problem asks for. And finally, the jet of F at any point x, as in the slide, the jet at x of F is supposed to lie in gamma 0. And, well, the jet at x of F is just p0. So I'm saying that p0 belongs to there's another misprint. That x0 should be an x in the third red box. And that's what we just saw by thinking about blue dots and red dots. Okay? And so this trivial interpolant taking F to be p0 solves the problem, because somehow the gammas are so big that you can't possibly get into trouble, and so you win easily. Okay, and so as promised, in the base case, where the label is script M, we can solve the local interpolation problem. And so the main one is true in the base case. Well, that was the base case. Now we have to do the induction step, which, guess what, is harder than the base case. All right, so let's talk about the induction step. All right, so let's fix a label A. Now, I didn't say it, but the label that we fix should be other than the base case. Let's assume that the main lemma holds for all smaller labels, where smaller is in terms of this order. Okay. And under that assumption, I want to prove the main lemma for A. Okay, if we can do that, then we'll complete the induction on A, and therefore prove the main lemma for all A, and therefore prove today's main theorem, and therefore prove a whole lot of theorems from previous talks. Okay, so again, this is what we want to do. Our label A is fixed. We're assuming the main lemma for all smaller labels, and we want to prove the main lemma for the given label A. That's the heart of the matter. Okay, now, there are two cases. Our label A is either monotonic or it isn't. On the next slide, I'll tell you what monotonic means. But for the moment, let me just say that the important case is the monotonic case, and the non-monotonic case is trivial. All right, so in order to do this induction step, I'm going to distinguish two cases. So what does monotonic mean? Well, remember, a label A is simply a set of all the indices of order less than or equal to m minus 1. Now, script A is called monotonic if the following holds. Look at the condition on the box. So we take an alpha in A and we add to it some other multi-index beta. That may fail to belong to A for trivial reasons, because maybe alpha plus beta is of order greater than or equal to M, in which case, by definition, it cannot possibly belong to A. But the condition in the green box is that if alpha is in A and beta is any multi-index, and if alpha plus beta is of order at most m minus 1, then it also belongs to alpha. Notice this obviously has something to do with multiplying polynomials by monomials. So this has something to do with multiplication, and therefore this has something to do with Whitney T convexity. That homework sits in the background. Okay. All right, so why is the non-monotonic case essentially trivial? It's because of the following lemma. So suppose we have a label, and suppose we have two multi-indices, alpha and beta, and alpha is in A, and alpha plus beta is in script M, but not in A. So, of course, the non-monotonic case means precisely that there are such alpha and beta. Okay. In that case, any local interpolation problem that carries the label script A also carries the label A hat, which is the union of A with this missing multi-index alpha plus beta. Okay. Suppose we believe that for a moment. Suppose we believe this lemma. Well, notice that A hat strictly contains A, and so A hat strictly precedes A in the order relation. And from that, and a few other little remarks about how we pick the constants, the lemma immediately applies our induction step in the non-monotonic case, because we're given a local interpolation problem that carries the label A, and the lemma tells us that it carries the label A hat, and we're assuming that that anything that carries the label A hat can be solved. So, end of story. So the non-monotonic case is trivial. Okay? Well, I have to prove the lemma. But the lemma has something in you. You're given a basis, you're given a collection of polynomials, you try multiplying them by monomials, you fuss, it works. Let me omit the proof for a while. But let me just remark that the proof of the lemma uses the Whitney T convexity of the set sigma L, because we're multiplying polynomials that we know belong to sigma L by polynomials. Okay. So we're done with the non-monotonic piece. All right. So as I keep on saying, we're now at the heart of the matter. The induction. Here's the induction step in the monotonic case. I think I have just enough time to mention one irrelevancy, which this simply reminds me of. So there is an interesting novel by Zola, Thérèse Raquin. The main character goes insane, and at perhaps 8 or 10 places in the novel, Zola writes, and this is when Thérèse finally cracks up. And so here at 8 or 10 places, finally we were at the heart of the matter. Okay. All right. So what is the heart of the matter? We've fixed a monotonic label other than strict M. We're assuming the main lemma for all labels A hat strictly less than A. We fix a particular local interpolation problem, lips of zero, as on the slide. We assume that it carries the label A, but it does not carry any smaller label. And we assume that our polynomial P0, given in the local interpolation problem, belongs to the appropriate gamma. Okay, so those are our assumptions. And under those assumptions, we have to solve the local interpolation problem. That's the induction step in the monotonic case. That's the heart of the matter. Okay, how will we do that? No plan. Okay, so we're going to solve this local interpolation problem in steps. First, we're going to take the Q0 that we're given, and we're going to take 3Q0 and cut it up into Calderon-Zsigmond subcubes by making a suitable Calderon-Zsigmond decomposition to be specified later. Okay, so we cut 3Q0 up into finitely many subcubes. On each of these subcubes, we're going to find a nearby point of E and an appropriate polynomial. Our Calderon-Zsigmond stopping rule guarantees that there is a point of E sufficiently near to Q0. And we're going to find the p nu associated to the q nu by moving to nearby points. The point that we're given initially is x0, the base point for the local interpolation problem, and the nearby point to which we're going to move is the point x nu that we just picked. So now we have an x nu, a q nu, a p nu, and let's see. And so then for each nu, we consider the local interpolation problem corresponding to that Calderon-Zsigmond Q. So for each nu, we have a Calderon-Zsigmond Q, Q nu. We picked a base point X nu near to Q nu, and we picked a polynomial P nu that seems to have something to do with the problem. Our Calderon-Zsigmond rule is going to guarantee that this local interpolation problem satisfies the hypotheses of the main lemma for some A nu hat, where A nu hat depends on nu, but A nu hat is some label strictly less than A. Okay, why is that? Well, it's not so easy to understand if I haven't so much as told you what the Calderon-Zsigmond rule is. but let's believe it. This can be done. And this will hold except in trivial cases. For instance, it may happen that you intersect through Q mu is the empty set, in which case we don't want to think to work out local interpolation problems of labels. Interpolating a desirable function to do the right thing over an empty set is not very hard. So except in trivial cases, we are in the setting of local interpolation problems with labels that precede A, and so the induction hypothesis tells us that except in trivial cases, we can solve the local interpolation problem and produce a function f nu that lives in 3 q nu and does what we want, localized to q nu. Okay? Well, that leaves the trivial cases, but in the trivial cases, we can also construct suitable f nu because the trivial cases are trivial. Okay? And so we now have a solution of local interpolation problems for each nu. We then introduce a Whitney partition of unity corresponding to our particular Calderon sigma decomposition. So on our big Q, 3Q0, our cutoff function is theta nu sum to 1. Each theta nu is supported in 1.01 times Q nu, the slight dilated Q nu, on which our F nu has good properties, and the theta nu are as smooth as possible as usual. Okay, so we introduce a Whitney partition of unity, and using that Whitney partition of unity, we're going to patch together our local solutions F nu into what we hope is a global solution of our local, a global solution of a local interpolation problem. Okay, the full solution of the local interpolation problem for T0. Is that clear? So we're going to cut into small pieces, and each piece will be either trivial or carry a better label, and therefore by induction solve the local pieces, and then we'll put them all together. Partition. That's the plan. Alright, let's execute the plan. Okay, step one, we make a Calderon sigma decomposition by starting with 3q0 and bisecting it, bisecting again, and so on until we are happy. So I have to tell you what it means for us to be happy. What is the stopping rule? Okay, so here is the rule. We are happy with the cube if one of two things happens. Either E intersect 3q contains at most one point, or, roughly speaking, the problem localized to the smaller cube carries a better label than A. Well, that's not exactly what the what condition B says. And in fact, the proof, so of course I'm not showing the proof in detail, I'm just sketching it. If you go through it carefully, it depends very sensitively on the little details of how this B is formulated. So maybe I'll just mention a couple of little details. But first note that in case A, if you're trying to solve a local interpolation problem on a Q-satisfying property A, you are looking for an interpolator that does what you want at one point. That's not very hard. Okay. So indeed, that's a trivial case. All right, now let's look carefully at B. So we have some label script A, A hat less than A. Okay, now I didn't explicitly mention labels, but I mentioned a basis. And so this basis is, of course, what the thing that is used to define labels. Now notice that the set of multi-indices here is now A hat. I've taken the corresponding delta as a carefully chosen constant, which depends on A, not on A hat, multiplied by delta Q, the sign length of this Q. And the harmless constant, CB tilde, also depends on A rather than A hat. And this is a basis for a certain sigma. And which sigma is it? It's sigma L of A minus 3. And let's see. So notice that which sigma we choose depends on A and not on A hat. So it's L of A minus 3, and it's L of A minus 3 at Z for all Z in E intersect 3Q. In order to apply the main lemma, it would be enough to have this at 1Z. But nevertheless, the Calderon-Sigma rule has to look like this. Notice that L of A has decreased by 3, and that motivates the answer to Andrea's question. I want to be sure that if A hat is less than A, that L of a hat is less than or equal to L of a minus 3. Yes?
Why can't you simply deal with the first situation? You will reach A.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, so...
why do you need a smaller label?
Okay, okay. So, well, if I just used A, I would get a Calderon Zygmund decomposition, but I wouldn't be able to use it to prove the main lemma. Okay, so I would be localizing much more with the one you propose than with this one. And each local interpolation problem would be trivial, but I would not be able to patch them together. So that answer wasn't quite as crisp as the answer to the previous question, but I got there. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so this is the Calderon-Zygmund rule, which will balance the need for the localized problems to be tractable with the need to be able to patch the localized problems together. Okay. Any more questions? Okay. All right, now, because E is finite, every small enough cube satisfies A. Was a very small cube, depending on the set E, then of course A is true. So eventually we stop cutting, and so we obtain this way a partition of 3Q0 into finitely many Calderon-Zygmund cubes. That's right. The cubes have good geometry, that is, if two of these cubes touch, their side lengths differ by at most a factor of 4. That's not obvious, but it is true, and I will not torture you by going through the proof. Yes?
So can you give a definition of a basis? Strong basis in other contexts?
Oh, you know a thing.
So is that true? It doesn't have this, it doesn't improve.
Let me speak specifically to you without trying to make my answer make sense to people who haven't very carefully studied the subject. If there's a strong basis for a better A hat, then there's a weak basis for that better A hat, and therefore there's a weak basis when you look at the smaller cube, and therefore by some lemma that you know perfectly well, there is a strong basis for a possibly different label, which however is less than or equal to the label A hat, which is already less than A.
Okay.
Have I answered that to your satisfaction?
Yeah.
Okay. And if you didn't follow all that, that's why I'm not going to explain why there was no geometry. But it's important that there should be this good geometry because that allows for the construction of Whitney partition unity as in the classical 1934 Whitney theorem. Okay, so now we have our Whitney partition as indicated on the slide. The usual conditions hold. And we're going to let all of that's good. Now, our Q nu arise from successive bisection by some Calderon-Zygmund rule. And so for each Q nu, we know that we are happy with it, but we are not happy with its dyadic parent, that is, with the cube that was last cut up in order to create it. Okay. You could ask, wait a minute, what if we were already happy with 3Q0 itself? But in that case, the problem we're trying to solve already carries an easier label and everything would be trivial. And in fact, if you look n slides earlier, I assumed that the problem at the moment does not carry that. We are happy with the cube nu, but we are unhappy with its dyadic parent that contains it and then has twice as large a side length. And we will exploit that to the hilt. Okay. Now, because we are, in particular, because we are unhappy with Q nu plus, the dyadic parent, Q nu plus cannot satisfy condition A. So we cannot have it, it cannot be the case that if we look at E intersect 3 times Q nu plus, that contains at most one point of E. So E intersect 3 Q nu plus contains at least 2 points of E, and therefore there exists an X nu, which is in some dilate of Q nu, intersect E. So there's a point in E nearby, as promised. So that's going to be our X nu. Of course, we have freedom in picking this X nu. In particular, we know we have at least two choices. Let us take X nu to be in 3Q nu intersect E, if possible. It's conceivable 3 qu intersect B is empty, but 3 qu plus intersect B has at least 2 points, and in that case, we can't do this. But if possible, we take X mu to be 3 qu intersect B. And there's a very special case, I don't know why I call it an exception, but a very special case. If our base point that was specified in the statement of the local interpolation problem, if that base point x0 happens to belong to E intersect 3 q mu, then we should take x mu to be x0, so that whatever we demanded at the base point will follow by induction from whatever we demanded at the base point for the subproblems. Okay? All right. So we have now cut up 3 q0 into Clausius-Zinkel cubes. We've constructed a Whitney partition of unity, and we've introduced base points in E that lie near the cube. So we're well on our way to executing the plan. Any questions? Or did I hope this is clear? Yes?
So, could you say something about what the relation is of this Clausius-Zinkel decomposition with what you mentioned at the beginning of the course, maybe that the hard cases are where the data lies near
Yes. So, unfortunately, I think the words hard and easy are now interchanged for the first lecture. If there is a label with a lot of stuff, that means that there are a lot of directions in which there are a lot of polynomials. So it lies near the zero set of those polynomials. Hard in the first lecture meant, oh dear, we have to take this into account. If we don't take this into account, we're dead. But now we are taking it into account. We've decided how to take it into account. And so now the definitions of hard and easy are interchanged, because if we know that E lies near the zero set of a lot of polynomials, we have information that we can turn to our advantage. Thank you for that question. Any other questions? Okay, so again, we've made our Clausius-Zinkel decomposition, we've got our cubes, we've got our base points x mu, we've got our Whitney partition of unity, and the next thing to do is to find the polynomial p mu in an appropriate L corresponding to the x mu. And we can do that because we know how to move to nearby points. And so we move from the point x0. Remember, we're given as part of the loop, we are given a p0 that belongs to an appropriate gamma at the base point x0. And so because we can move to the nearby point, we can move to nearby points, there exists a p nu in a slightly different gamma. Notice instead of L of A, it's L of A minus 1 at x nu, and it lies close in the sense of the box. Okay, so we have picked a p mu. Okay, let's try using that p mu. So, and notice that in particular at the base point, I've done no violence. I haven't changed anything. That's a minor detail. Okay, so where do we stand? I think there's enough stuff going on that I better keep reminding you where we stand. So, 3Q0 is partitioned into Clausius-Zinkel cubes. We're happy with each Clausius-Zinkel cube, but we're unhappy with its parent. We have found a base point lying in E and close to Q nu, and we have found a polynomial P nu in an appropriate gamma. The Q nu have good geometry, and they give rise to a Whitney partition of unity. So here's the picture. Here's the biggest cube in the picture is 3q0. The red dots are the finite set E. The finite set E is decomposed. I'm sorry, the cube 3q0 is decomposed into Clausius-Zinkel cubes q nu, one of which is indicated in solid green. 3q nu is indicated in dotted green. Now, our local interpolation problem comes with a base point x0, which is shown in the picture. It's one of the red dots labeled black, so x0, and there is a polynomial p0 that is associated with the statement of the problem. Okay, and now we have picked our base point x nu, and it happens in this case to lie in E intersect q nu. And we have associated to the baseball taxi. So that's what we've got so far. That's a picture of the situation so far. So the next thing we're going to do is to formulate local interpolation problems for the Q nu. So let's fix a particular Q nu. We know that we're happy with Q nu. So either we're in a trivial case, and 3 Q nu contains at most one point of E, or for some label A hat less than A, the local interpolation problem for the Q nu, the base point X nu, and the polynomial P nu carries the label A hat. Okay, so that's what happens in the non-trivial case. Okay, and a technical detail. If you remember the definition of Calderon-Zygmund rule, we talked about, we took L to be L of A minus 3, and if we want to know that our local problem for Q nu carries the label A hat, we are looking at L of A hat. So it's important that L of A hat is less than or equal to L of A minus 3. And again, that motivates the answer to Andrea's question. That's the detail. Okay. All right. Anyway, so each of these local interpolation problems in the non-trivial case carries a label A hat strictly less than A. Aha! But remember, we can solve those local interpolation problems by the induction hypothesis. So for each Q nu, we produce an F nu, which satisfies the conditions on the slide. We control its nth derivatives. We specify that it's jet. At each point of E intersect, a slight dilated Q nu belongs to gamma zero. And furthermore, we specify what the jet is at X nu. Now, that's what happens in the non-trivial case. So in the non-trivial case, we produce such an F nu by applying the main lemma for A hat, which is our induction hypothesis. Okay. In the trivial case, we have to produce an F nu which does the right thing. But that's trivial because we're talking about an interpolation problem where the set E of which we want the interpolant to do something has only one point. So that's trivial. Let's not discuss it further. By the way, there's a super trivial case in which E intersect 3 Q nu is empty, so there are no points at which we want our interpolator to do anything. And in that case, we can just take F nu to mean the polynomial P nu. Alright. So now we have cut 3 Q0 into Calderon-Zygmund Qs and produced local interpolants. Oh my god. I'm sorry, I will go 5 minutes over. We produced our local interpolants, F nu, and I shouldn't have talked about tonight, so okay. Great. We made our partition unity, and so for the grand finale, we want to patch together our F nu by setting F equal to the sum on nu of theta nu F nu, and we hope that that solves our local interpolation problems. Oops, it doesn't work. So I have 5 minutes to tell you why it doesn't work and what to do about it. Okay? So in order to estimate the nth derivatives of the patched up function, we need mutual consistency of the F nu. That is the estimate on the box where del nu is the side length of Q nu, which may be much, much smaller than the side length of the original Q0. So we need that to happen. Otherwise, when we patch things together, we will have no control on the derivatives. And that issue already arose in the proof of the classical Lipkin extension theorem. So we had better have an estimate like this. Okay, now it's easy to estimate the derivatives of F nu minus P nu, and they're small enough, and so the mutual consistency of the F nu is easily seen to be equivalent to the mutual consistency of the polynomials P nu that I associated to the base points for the local problems. Okay, so here's the estimate we need, but that may fail. And the reason it may fail is, remember how we picked the P nu. We picked the P nu in gamma L of A minus 1, sufficiently close to P0, but sufficiently close refers to the length scale of the full problem, the Q0 rather than the Q nu. So this sufficiently close is not nearly close enough for us now. And furthermore, Q mu and Q nu are picked independently if mu and nu are any two cubes, for example, two cubes that touch. if A is not empty, there is a lot of room to maneuver inside L of A minus 1. And so there is a lot of freedom in our choice of P mu and P mu, right? The A's tell us that we have room to maneuver unless they're empty. And if we have room to maneuver in picking P mu and P mu, and we pick them independently, it's highly unlikely that they'll be very close together. That's the problem. Okay. In order to solve this fundamental problem, we're going to exploit the freedom to maneuver in order to strengthen the basic property of the gammas that we used before. And so given a P0 in L of A, what we said before was that there exists a P2 at the X, at the gamma L of A minus 1 at X mu, which is close to P0 as on the slide. Okay? That's what we already knew. That was a basic property of the gammas. But now we're going to exploit our freedom of maneuver. And by exploiting our freedom of maneuver provided by the label A, and by the way, using also the fact that A is monotonic, that's why we had to get rid of the non-monotonic case, we can now prove that given our P0 and given our X mu, we can move from X0 to X mu and produce a P mu, which not only satisfies the previous conditions, but for which for all alpha in our label script A, the alpha derivatives of P mu minus P0 are identically zero. Remember earlier in the lecture there was some lemma about how you could change the alpha order derivatives. So that's where we exploit that. And so now we modify the previous discussion by picking each P mu to satisfy that additional condition. And the good news is that when we do that, the P mu become mutually consistent, which is a stroke of great good luck because they were picked independently. Nevertheless, they are mutually consistent. And that is because there is not too much room to maneuver inside there, inside the gamma. There is some room to maneuver, but not too much, and that's ultimately due to the fact that we don't like Q mu plus. And understanding that is the hardest part of the proof, but I have minus 4 minutes, and so let's just declare victory and believe it. And so we have completed our induction, handled the monotonic case. The non-monotonic case is trivial. So we have proven the main lemma, the main theorem for today. And all the results from lecture 3, we got through it. I'm sorry, I'm going to take one more minute. Similar ideas will underlie later treatment of Sobolev spaces, which unfortunately are harder. So if you like this, you will love that. So stay tuned. But there is a shorter coordinate-free proof due to the people on the slide, Jacob Harith, Fred Pearson, Aryeh Israel, and Boaz Klartok. It is coordinate-free. It's shorter than the one that I described, but I don't understand it as well. I hope to understand it in the next few months. It is shorter, it's coordinate-free, and that, I think, is going to allow lots of good things to happen. But, let's stay tuned. Okay, thank you.
Let's thank the speaker again. Coffee and snacks are available outside, and we'll reconvene at 10:30.